Yang Yin blurted. You'll want to be alone with your wife, will you not, Uncle? What?
Jamie stared at him uncomprehendingly.
Well, I mean...
Yang Yin hesitated, glancing at me, and then hastily away.
I mean, nay doot, you'll be wanting to,
A Highlander born, he managed to infuse this last noise with an amazing wealth of implied indelicacy. Jamie rubbed his knuckles hard across his upper lip.
Well, that's very thoughtful of you, Ian, he said.
His voice quivered slightly with the effort of not laughing.
And I'm flattered that you have such a high opinion of my virility as to think I'm capable of anything but sleeping in bed after a day like this. But I think perhaps I can forego the satisfaction of my carnal desires for one night. Fond as I am of your auntie, he added, giving me a faint grin.
But Bruno tells me the establishment is not busy tonight,
Fergus put in, glancing round in some bewilderment.
Why does the boy not?
Because he's no but 14, for God's sake,
Jamie said, scandalized.
Almost 15,
young Ian corrected, sitting up and looking interested.
Ah, that is certainly sufficient,
Fergus said, with a glance at Madame Jeanne for confirmation.
Your brothers were no older when I first brought them here, and they acquitted themselves honourably.
You what?
Jamie goggled at his protégé.
Well, someone had to,
Fergus said, with slight impatience.
Normally a boy's father. But of course le monsieur is not...
Meaning no disrespect, your esteemed father, of course, he added with a nod to young Ian, who nodded back like a mechanical toy.
But it is a matter for experienced judgment, you understand.
Now, he turned to Madame Jeanne with the air of a gourmand consulting the wine steward.
Dorcas, do you think, or Penelope?
No, no, she said, shaking her head decidedly.
It should be the second Mary, absolutely. The small one.
Oh, with the yellow hair?
Yes, I think you are right,
Fergus said approvingly.
Fetch her, then.
Jeanne was off before Jamie could manage more than a strangled croak in protest.
But the lad canna,
he began.
Yes, I can, young Ian said. At least, I think I can.
It wasn't possible for his face to grow any redder, but his ears were crimson with excitement, the traumatic events of the day completely forgotten.
But it's... that's to say, I canna be letting you,
Jamie broke off, and stood glaring at his nephew for a long moment. Finally, he threw his hands up in the air in exasperated defeat.
"'And what am I to say to your mother?'
he demanded, as the door opened behind him. Framed in the door stood a very short young girl, plump and soft as a partridge, in her blue silk chemise, her round sweet face beaming beneath a loose cloud of yellow hair. At the sight of her, young Ian froze, scarcely breathing. When at last he must draw breath or die, he drew it and turned to Jamie. With a smile of surpassing sweetness, he said,
"Well, Uncle Jamie, if I were you..."
His voice soared up in a sudden alarming soprano, and he stopped, clearing his throat before resuming in a respectable baritone,
"I wouldna tell her. Good night to ye, auntie," he said,
and walked purposely forward.
"I canna decide whether I must kill Fergus or thank him."
Jamie was sitting on the bed in our attic room, slowly unbuttoning his shirt. I laid the damp dress over the stool and knelt down in front of him to unbuckle the knee buckles of his breeches.
I suppose he was trying to do his best for young Ian.
Aye. And his bloody immoral French way.
Jamie reached back to untie the lace that held his hair back. He hadn't plaited it again when we left Mowbray's, and it fell soft and loose on his shoulders, framing the broad cheekbones and long straight nose, so that he looked like one of the fiercer Italian angels of the Renaissance. "Was it the Archangel Michael who drove Adam and Eve out of the Garden of Eden?" I asked, stripping off his stockings. He gave a slight chuckle.
"Do I strike you so, as the guardian of virtue, and Fergus as the wicked serpent?"
His hands came under my elbows as he bent to lift me up.
Gab Sassnach, you shouldn't be on your knees serving me.
You've had rather a time of it today yourself, I answered, making him stand up with me. Even if you didn't have to kill anyone. There were large blisters on his hands, and while he had wiped away most of the soot, there was still a streak down the side of his jaw. My hands went around his waist to help with the waistband of his breeches, but he held them there, resting his cheek for a moment against the top of my head.
I wasn't quite honest with the lad, you ken, he said.
No, I thought you did wonderfully with him. He felt better after he talked to you, at least.
Aye, I hope so. And maybe the prayers and such will help. They kinda hurt him, at least. But I didn't tell him everything.
What else is there? I tilted up my face to his, touching his lips softly with my own. He smelled of smoke and sweat.
What a man most often does when he's soul sick with killing is to find a woman, Sassnach, he answered softly. His own, if he can. Another, if he must. For she can do what he cannot, and heal him.
My fingers found the lacing of his fly. It came loose with a tug. That's why you let him go with the second Mary. He shrugged, and stepping back a pace, pushed the breeches down and off.
I couldn't stop him. And I think perhaps I was right to let him, young as he is.
He smiled crookedly at me.
At least he'll not be fashing and fretting himself over that seaman tonight.
I don't imagine so. And what about you? I pulled the chemise off over my head.
Me?
He stared down at me, eyebrows raised, the grimy linen shirt hanging loose upon his shoulders. I glanced behind him at the bed. Yes. You haven't killed anyone, but do you want to?
Mm-hmm.
I met his gaze, raising my own brows in question. The smile broadened across his face, and any resemblance to Michael, stern guardian of virtue, vanished. He lifted one shoulder, then the other, and let them fall, and the shirt slid down his arms to the floor.
I expect I do, he said. But you'll be gentle with me, aye.
Chapter 29 Culloden's Last Victim. In the morning, I saw Jamie and Ian off on their pious errand, and then set off myself, stopping to purchase a large wicker basket from a vendor in the street. It was time I began to equip myself again with whatever I could find in the way of medical supplies. After the events of the preceding day, I was beginning to fear I would have need of them before long. Hawes Apothecary Shop hadn't changed at all through English occupation, Scottish rising, and the Stuarts' fall, and my heart rose in delight as I stepped through the door into the rich, familiar smells of hartshorn, peppermint, almond oil, and anise. The man behind the counter was Hawes, but a much younger whore than the middle-aged man I had dealt with 20 years before when I had patronised this shop for titbits of military intelligence, as well as for nostrums and herbs. The younger whore didn't know me, of course, but went courteously about the business of finding the herbs I wanted among the neatly ranged jars on his shelves. A good many were common, rosemary, tansy, marigold, but a few on my list made the young whore's ginger eyebrows rise, and his lips purse in thoughtfulness as he looked over the jars. There was another customer in the shop, hovering near the counter, where tonics were dispensed and compounds ground to order. He strode back and forth, hands clasped behind his back, obviously impatient. After a moment, he came up to the counter.
How long?
He snapped at Mr. Hawes' back.
I canna just say, Reverend.
The apothecary's voice was apologetic.
Louisa did say as 'twould need to be boiled.
The only reply to this was a snort, and the man, tall and narrow-shouldered in black, resumed his pacing, glancing from time to time at the doorway to the back room, where the invisible Louisa was presumably at work. The man looked slightly familiar, but I had no time to think where I had seen him before. Mr. Hall was squinting dubiously at the list I had given him.
"Aconite, no," he muttered. "Aconite, and what might that be, I wonder?"
"Well, it's poison for one thing," I said.
Mr. Hall's mouth dropped open momentarily.
"It's a medicine, too," I assured him. "But you have to be careful in the use of it. Externally, it's good for rheumatism, but a very tiny amount taken by mouth will lower the rate of the pulse. Good for some kinds of heart trouble."
"Really?"
Mr. Hall said, blinking. He turned to his shells, looking rather helpless.
Do you ken what it smells like, maybe?"
Taking this for invitation, I came round the counter and began to sort through the jars. They were all carefully labelled, but the labels of some were clearly old, the ink faded, and the paper peeling at the edges.
"I'm afraid I'm none so canny with the medicines as my da yet," young Mr. Hall was saying at my elbow. "He taught me a good bit, but then he passed on a year ago, and there's things here as I dinna ken the use of, I'm afraid."
"Well, that one's good for cough," I said, taking down a jar of elecampane, with a glance at the impatient reverend who had taken out a handkerchief and was wheezing asthmatically into it. "Particularly sticky-sounding coughs."
I frowned at the crowded shelves. Everything was dusted and immaculate, but evidently not filed according either to alphabetical or botanical order. Had old Mr. Haw merely remembered where things were, or had he a system of some kind? I closed my eyes and tried to remember the last time I had been in the shop. To my surprise, the image came back easily. I had come for foxglove then, to make the infusions for Alex Randall, younger brother of Black Jack Randall, and Frank's six times great-grandfather. Poor boy, he'd been dead now 20 years, though he had lived long enough to sire a son. I felt a twinge of curiosity at the thought of that son, and of his mother, who had been my friend. But I forced my mind away from them, back to the image of Mr. Hoare standing on tiptoe to reach up to his shelves over near the right-hand side.
There!
Sure enough, my hand rested near the jar labelled Foxglove. To one side of it was a jar labelled Horsetail, to the other Lily of the Valley Root. I hesitated, looking at them, running over in my mind the possible uses of those herbs. Cardiac herbs, all of them. If aconite was to be found, it would be close by then. It was. I found it quickly, in a jar labelled Old Wives' Hood.
"Be careful with it,"
I handed the jar gingerly to Mr. Hoare. "Even a bit of it will make your skin go numb. Perhaps I'd better have a glass bottle for it." Most of the herbs I'd bought had been wrapped up in squares of gauze or twisted in screws of paper. But the young Mr. Hoare nodded and carried the jar of aconite into the back room, held at arm's length, as though he expected it to explode in his face.
"You'd seem to know a good deal more about the medicines than the lad," said a deep, hoarse voice behind me.
"Well, I've somewhat more experience than he has, likely." I turned to find the minister leaning on the counter, watching me under thick brows with pale blue eyes. I realised with a start where I had seen him, in Mowbray's, the day before. He gave no sign of recognising me, perhaps because my cloak covered Daphne's dress. I had noticed that many men took relatively little notice of the face of a woman en décolletage, though it seemed a regrettable habit in a clergyman. He cleared his throat.
"And you ken what to do for a nervous complaint, then?"
"What sort of nervous complaint?" He pursed his lips and frowned, as though unsure whether to trust me. The upper lip came to a slight point like an owl's beak, but the lower was thick and pendulous.
"Well, 'tis a complicated case, but to speak generally now,"
he eyed me carefully,
"what would you give for a sort of fit?"
"Epileptic seizure?" where the person falls down and twitches. He shook his head, showing a reddened band about his neck where the high white stock had chafed it.
No, a different kind of fit. Screaming and staring.
Screaming and staring?
Not at once, you ken,
he added hastily.
First the one and then the other, or rather round about. First she'll do naught but stare for days on end, not speaking. And then all of a sudden she'll scream fit to wake the deed.
That sounds very trying. It did. If he had a wife so afflicted, it could easily explain the deep lines of strain that bracketed his mouth and eyes, and the blue circles of exhaustion beneath his eyes. I tapped a finger on the counter, considering. I don't know. I'd have to see the patient. The minister's tongue touched his lower lip.
Perhaps would you be willing, maybe, to come and see her? It isn't far,
he added, rather stiffly. Pleading didn't come naturally to him, but the urgency of his request communicated itself despite the stiffness of his figure. I can't just now, I told him. I have to meet my husband. But perhaps this afternoon?
2 o'clock,
he said promptly.
Henderson's in Carruthers Close. Campbell is the name. The Reverend Archibald Campbell.
This ends Disc 15. Voyager, Disc 16.
Before I could say yes or no, the curtain between the front room and the back twitched aside, and Mr. Hoare appeared with 2 bottles, one of which he handed to each of us. The Reverend eyed his with suspicion as he groped in his pocket for a coin.
"Well, and there's your price,"
he said ungraciously, slapping it on the counter.
"And we'll hope as you've given me the right one and know the lady's poison."
The curtain rustled again, and a woman looked out after the departing form of the minister.
"Good riddance," she remarked. "Heapence for an hour's work and insult on the top of it. The Lord might have chosen better, is all I can see."
"Do you know him?" I asked, curious whether Louisa might have any helpful information about the afflicted wife.
"Not to say I ken him weel, no,"
Louisa said, staring at me in frank curiosity.
"He's one of the Free Church ministers as is always ranting on the corner by the Market Cross, telling folk as their behaviour is of nae consequence at all, and all that's needful for salvation is that they shall come to grips with Jesus. Like as if our Lord was to be a fair day wrestler."
She sniffed disdainfully at this heretical viewpoint, crossing herself against contamination.
"I'm surprised the likes of the Reverend Campbell should come in our shop, hearing what he thinks of papists, by and large."
Her eyes sharpened at me.
"But you maybe be Free Church yourself, ma'am, meaning no offence to you, if so."
"No, I'm a Catholic, a papist too," I assured her. "I was only wondering whether you knew anything about the Reverend's wife and her condition."
Louisa shook her head, turning to deal with a new customer. "Nee, I've never seen the lady, but whatever's the matter with her," she added, frowning after the departed Reverend, "I'm sure that living with him doesn't improve it any."
The weather was chill but clear, and only a faint hint of smoke lingered in the rectory garden as a reminder of the fire. Jamie and I sat on a bench against the wall, absorbing the pale winter sunshine as we waited for young Ian to finish his confession.
"Did you tell Ian that load of rubbish he gave young Ian yesterday? About where I'd been all this time?"
"Oh, aye," he said. "Ian's a good deal too canny to believe it, but it's a likely enough story, and he's too good a friend to insist on the truth."
"I suppose it will do for general consumption," I agreed.
"But shouldn't you have told it to Sir Percival instead of letting him think we were newlyweds?"
He shook his head decidedly.
"Och, no. For the one thing, Sir Percival has no notion of my real name, though I'll lay a year's takings he knows it isn't a Malcolm. I dinna want him to be thinking of me and Culloden together by any means. And for another, a story like the one I gave Ian would cause the devil of a lot more talk than the news that the printer's taken a wife."
"Oh, what a tangled web we weave," I intoned,
when first we practice to deceive.
He gave me a quick blue glance, and the corner of his mouth lifted slightly.
It gets a bit easier with practice, Sassenach, he said. Try living Wima for a time, and you'll find yourself spinning silk out of your ass as easy as kiss my hand.
I burst out laughing.
I want to see you do that, I said. You already have.
He stood up and craned his neck, trying to see over the wall into the rectory garden.
Young Ian's being the devil of a time, he remarked, sitting down again. How can a lad not yet 15 have that much to confess?
After the day and night he had yesterday.
I suppose it depends how much detail Father Hayes wants to hear, I said, with a vivid recollection of my breakfast with the prostitutes.
Has he been in there all this time?
No.
The tips of Jamie's ears grew slightly pinker in the morning light.
I had to go first. As an example, you can.
No wonder it took some time, I said, teasing. How long has it been since you've been to confession?
I told Father Hayes it was 6 months.
And was it?
No. But I suppose if he was going to shrive me for thieving, assault and profane language, he might as well shrive me for lying, too.
What? No fornication or impure thoughts?
Certainly not, he said austerely. You can think any manner of horrible things without sin, and it's to do with your wife. It's only if you're thinking about other ladies it's impure.
I had no idea I was coming back to save your soul, I said primly, but it's nice to be useful. He laughed, bent, and kissed me thoroughly.
I wonder if that counts as an indulgence, he said,
pausing for breath.
It ought to, no? It does a great deal more to keep a man from the fires of hell than saying the rosary does. Speaking of which, he added, digging into his pocket and coming out with a rather chewed-looking wooden rosary, remind me that I must say my penance sometime today. I was about to start on it when you came up.
How many Hail Marys are you supposed to say? I asked, fingering the beads. The chewed appearance wasn't illusion. There were definite small tooth marks on most of the beads.
I met a Jew last year, he said, ignoring the question. A natural philosopher who'd sailed round the world 6 times. He told me that in both the Muslim faith and the Jewish teachings, it was considered an act of virtue for a man and his wife to lie with each other. I wonder if that has anything to do with both Jews and Muslims being circumcised, he added thoughtfully. I never thought to ask him that, though perhaps he would have found it indelicate to say.
I shouldn't think a foreskin more or less would impair the virtue, I assured him.
Oh, good, he said,
and kissed me once more. What happened to your rosary? I asked, picking up the string where it had fallen on the grass. It looks like the rats have been at it.
Not rats, he said. Bairns.
What bairns?
Oh, any that might be about.
He shrugged, tucking the beads back in his pocket.
Young Jimmy has 3 now, and Maggie and Kitty 2 each. Wee Michael's just married, but his wife's breeding.
The sun was behind him, darkening his face so that his teeth flashed suddenly white when he smiled.
You didn't ken you were a great aunt 7 times over, eh?
A great aunt? I said, staggered.
Well, I'm a great uncle, he said cheerfully, and I haven't found it a terrible trial, except for having my beads gnawed when the wains are cutting teeth. That, and being expected to answer to Nunky a lot.
Sometimes 20 years seemed like an instant, and sometimes it seemed like a very long time indeed.
Ah, there isn't a feminine equivalent of Nunky, I hope. Oh, no, he assured me. They'll all call you Great Auntie Claire, and treat you with the utmost respect.
Thanks a lot, I muttered, with visions of the hospital's geriatric wing fresh in my mind. Jamie laughed, and with a lightness of heart no doubt engendered by being newly freed from sin, grasped me around the waist and lifted me onto his lap.
I've never before seen a great auntie with a lovely plump arse like that, he said with approval,
bouncing me slightly on his knees. His breath tickled the back of my neck as he leaned forward. I let out a small shriek as his teeth closed lightly on my ear.
"Are you all right, auntie?"
said young Ian's voice just behind us, full of concern. Jamie started convulsively, nearly unshipping me from his lap, then tightened his hold on my waist.
"Oh, aye," he said. "It's just your auntie saw a spider."
"Where?"
said young Ian, peering interestedly over the bench.
"Up there."
Jamie rose, standing me on my feet, and pointed to the lime tree where, sure enough, the web of an orb weaver stretched across the crook of two branches, sparkling with damp. The weaver herself sat in the centre, round as a cherry, wearing a gaudy pattern of green and yellow on her back.
"I was telling your auntie," Jamie said, as young Ian examined the web in lashless fascination, "about a Jew I met, a natural philosopher. He'd made a study of spiders, it seems. In fact, he was in Edinburgh to deliver a learned paper to the Royal Society, in spite of being a Jew."
"Really? Did he tell you a lot about spiders?"
young Ian asked eagerly.
"A lot more than I cared to know," Jamie informed his nephew. "There are times and places for talking of spiders that lay eggs and caterpillars, so the young hatch out and devour the poor beast while it's still alive. But during supper isn't a one of them." "He did say one thing I thought very interesting, though," he added, squinting at the web.
He blew gently on it, and the spider scuttled briskly into hiding.
"He said that spiders spin two kinds of silk, and if you have a lens, and can make the spider sit still for it, I suppose, you can see the two places where the silk comes out. Spinnerets, he called them. In any case, the one kind of silk is sticky, and if a wee bug touches it, he's done for. But the other kind is dry silk, like the sort you'd embroider with, but finer."
The orb weaver was advancing cautiously toward the centre of her web again.
"See where she walks?"
Jamie pointed to the web, anchored by a number of spokes supporting the intricate net-like whorl.
"The spokes there, those are spun of the dry silk, so the spider can walk over it herself wi' no trouble. But the rest of the web is the sticky kind of silk, or mostly so. And if you watch a spider careful for quite a long time, you'll see that she goes only on the dry strands, for if she walked on the sticky stuff, she'd be stuck herself."
"Is that so?"
Ian breathed reverently on the web, watching intently as the spider moved away along her non-skid road to safety.
"I suppose there's a moral there for web weavers," Jamie observed to me, sotto voce. "Be sure you know which of your strands are sticky."
"I suppose it helps even more if you have the kind of luck that will conjure up a handy spider when you need one," I said dryly.
He laughed and took my arm.
"That's not luck, Sassenach," he told me. "It's watchfulness. Ian, are you coming?"
"Oh, aye."
Young Ian abandoned the web with obvious reluctance and followed us to the kirkyard gate.
"Oh, Uncle Jimmy, I meant to ask, can I borrow your rosary?"
he said as we emerged onto the cobbles of the Royal Mile.
"The priest told me I must say 5 decades for my penance, and that's too many to keep count of on my fingers."
"Surely."
Jamie stopped and fished in his pocket for the rosary.
"Be sure to give it back, though."
Young Ian grinned.
"Aye, I reckon you'll be needing it yourself, Uncle Jamie. The priest told me he was very wicked,"
young Ian confided to me with a lashless wink, "and told me not to be like him."
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie glanced up and down the road.
"How many decades of the rosary are you supposed to say as penance?"
I asked curiously.
85,
he muttered. The rosiness of his freshly shaved cheeks deepened. Young Ian's mouth dropped open in awe.
"How long has it been since you went to confession, Uncle?"
he asked.
"A long time," Jamie said tersely. "Come on."
Jamie had an appointment after dinner to meet with a Mr. Harding, representative of the Hand in Hand Assurance Society, which had insured the premises of the print shop, to inspect the ashy remains with him and verify the loss.
"I wouldn't need you, laddie," he said reassuringly to young Ian, who looked less than enthusiastic about the notion of revisiting the scene of his adventures. "You go with your auntie to see this madwoman." "I canna tell how you do it," he added to me, raising one brow. "You're in the city less than 2 days, and all the afflicted folk for miles about are clutching at your hems." "Hardly all of them," I said dryly. "It's only one woman after all, and I haven't even seen her yet." "Aye, well, at least madness isna catching, I hope."
He kissed me briefly, then turned to go, clapping young Ian companionably on the shoulder.
"Look after your auntie, Ian."
Young Ian paused for a moment, looking after the tall form of his departing uncle.
"Do you want to go with him, Ian?" I asked. "I can manage alone if you..." "Oh, no, auntie."
He turned back to me, looking rather abashed.
"I dinna want to go at all. It's only... I was wondering... Well, what if they... find anything? In the ashes?"
"A body, you mean?" I said bluntly. I had realised, of course, that the distinct possibility that Jamie and Mr. Harding would find the body of the one-eyed seaman was the reason Jamie had told Ian to accompany me.
The boy nodded, looking ill at ease. His skin had faded to a sort of rosy tan, but was still too dark to show any paleness due to emotion.
"I don't know," I said. "If the fire was a very hot one, there may be nothing much left to find." "But don't worry about it."
I touched his arm in reassurance.
"Your uncle will know what to do." "Aye, that's so."
His face brightened, full of faith in his uncle's ability to handle any situation whatever. I smiled when I saw his expression, then realised with a small start of surprise that I had that faith too. Be it drunken Chinese, corrupt customs agents, or Mr. Harding of the Hand in Hand Assurance Society, I hadn't any doubt that Jamie would manage.
"Come on, then," I said, as the bell in the Canongate Kirk began to ring. "It's just on 2 now."
Despite his visit to Father Hayes, Ian had retained a certain air of dreamy bliss, which returned to him now, and there was little conversation as we made our way up the slope of the Royal Mile to Henderson's lodging house in Carruthers Close. It was a quiet hotel, but luxurious by Edinburgh standards, with a patterned carpet on the stairs and coloured glass in the street window. It seemed rather rich surroundings for a Free Church minister, but then I knew little about Free Churchmen. Perhaps they took no vow of poverty as the Catholic clergy did. Showed up to the third floor by a young boy, we found the door opened to us at once by a heavy-set woman wearing an apron and a worried expression. I thought she might be in her mid-20s, though she had already lost several of her front teeth.
"You'll be the lady as the Reverend said would call?" she asked.
Her expression lightened a bit at my nod, and she swung the door wider.
"Mr. Campbell had to go out the noo," she said in a broad lowland accent. "But he said as how he'd be most obliged to hear your advice regarding his sister, mum."
"Sister, not wife." "Well, I'll do my best," I said. "May I see Miss Campbell?" Leaving Ian to his memories in the sitting room, I accompanied the woman who introduced herself as Nellie Cowden to the back bedroom. Miss Campbell was, as advertised, staring. Her pale blue eyes were wide open, but didn't seem to be looking at anything, certainly not at me. She sat in the sort of wide, low chair called a nursing chair, with her back to the fire. The room was dim, and the backlighting made her features indistinct, except for the unblinking eyes. Seen closer too, her features were still indistinct. She had a soft, round face, undistinguished by any apparent bone structure, and baby-fine brown hair neatly brushed. Her nose was small and snub, her chin double, and her mouth hung pinkly open, so slack as to obscure its natural lines.
"Miss Campbell?" I said cautiously.
There was no response from the plump figure in the chair. Her eyes did blink, I saw, though much less frequently than normal.
"She'll nae answer you while she's in this state," Nellie Cowden said behind me.
She shook her head, wiping her hands upon her apron.
Nay, not a word.
How long has she been like this? I picked up a limp, pudgy hand and felt for the pulse. It was there, slow and quite strong.
Ooh, for 2 days so far this time.
Becoming interested, Miss Cowden leaned forward, peering into her charge's face.
Usually she stays like that for a week or more. 13 days is the longest she's done it.
Moving slowly, though Miss Campbell seemed unlikely to be alarmed, I began to examine the unresisting figure, meanwhile asking questions of her attendant. Miss Margaret Campbell was 37, Miss Cowden told me, the only relative of the Reverend Archibald Campbell with whom she had lived for the past 20 years since the death of their parents. What starts her doing this, do you know? Miss Cowden shook her head.
No telling, mum. Nothing seems to start it. 1 minute she'll be looking about, talking and laughing, eating her dinner like the sweet child she is, and the next, whisht!
She snapped her fingers then for effect, leaned forward and snapped them again, deliberately, just under Miss Campbell's nose.
See, she said, how could he? 6 men with trumpets pass through the room and she'd pay it nae more mind.
I was reasonably sure that Miss Campbell's trouble was mental, not physical, but I made a complete examination anyway, or as complete as could be managed without undressing that clumsy, inert form.
It's when she comes out of it that's the worst, though,
Miss Cowden assured me, squatting next to me as I knelt on the floor to check Miss Campbell's plantar reflexes. Her feet, loosed from shoes and stockings, were damp and smelled musty. I drew a fingernail firmly down the sole of each foot in turn, checking for a Babinski reflex that might indicate the presence of a brain lesion. Nothing, though. Her toes curled under in normal startlement.
What happens then? Is that the screaming the Reverend mentioned? I rose to my feet. Will you bring me a lighted candle, please?
Oh, aye, the screaming.
Miss Cowden hastened to oblige, lighting a wax taper from the fire.
She do shriek something awful then, on and on, till she's worn herself out. Then she'll fall asleep, sleep the clock around, she will, and wake as though nothing had happened.
And she's quite all right when she wakes, I asked. I moved the candle flame slowly back and forth, a few inches before the patient's eyes. The pupils shrank in automatic response to the light, but the irises stayed fixed, not following the flame. My hand itched for the solid handle of an ophthalmoscope to examine the retinas, but no such luck.
Well, not to say all right, Miss Cowden said slowly.
I turned from the patient to look at her, and she shrugged, massive shoulders powerful under the linen of her blouse.
She's saft in the heid, poor dear, she said matter-of-factly. Has been for nigh on 20 year.
You haven't been taking care of her all that time, surely?
Oh, no. Mr. Campbell had a woman as cared for her when they lived in Burt Island, but the woman was none so young, and didn't wish to leave her home. So when the Reverend made up his mind to take up the Missionary Society's offer and to take his sister wi' him to the West Indies, why, he advertised for a strong woman o' good character who wouldn't mind travel to be an Abigail for her. And here I am.
Miss Cowden gave me a gap-toothed smile in testimony to her own virtues.
The West Indies? He's planning to take Miss Campbell on a ship to the West Indies?
I was staggered. I knew just enough of sailing conditions to think that any such trip would be a major ordeal to a woman in good health. This woman. But then I reconsidered. All things concerned, Margaret Campbell might endure such a trip better than a normal woman, at least if she remained in her trance.
He thought as the change of climate might be good for her, Miss Cowden was explaining. Get her away from Scotland and all the dreadful memories. Ought to have done it long since, is what I say.
What sort of dreadful memories? I asked. I could see by the gleam in Miss Cowden's eye that she was only too ready to tell me. I had finished the examination by this time, and concluded that there was little physically wrong with Miss Campbell, save inactivity and poor diet. But there was the chance that something in her history might suggest some treatment.
"Well," she began,
sidling toward the table where a decanter and several glasses stood on a tray.
"It's only what Tilly Lawson told me. Her has looked after Miss Campbell for so long. But she did swear it was the truth, and her a godly woman. If you'd care to take a drop of cordial, mum, for the sake of the Reverend's hospitality."
The chair Miss Campbell sat on was the only one in the room, so Miss Cowden and I perched inelegantly on the bed side by side and watched the silent figure before us as we sipped our blackberry cordial, and she told me Margaret Campbell's story. Margaret Campbell had been born in Burnt Island, no more than 5 miles from Edinburgh, across the Firth of Forth. At the time of the 45, when Charles Stuart had marched into Edinburgh to reclaim his father's throne, she'd been 17. Her father was a royalist, of course, and her brother in a government regiment marching north to put down the wicked rebels, said Miss Cowden, taking a tiny sip of the cordial to make it last.
But not Miss Margaret. Nay, she was for the bonny prince and the Hielan men that followed him.
One in particular, though Miss Cowden didn't know his name. But a fine man he must have been, for Miss Margaret stole away from her home to meet him, and told him all the bits of information that she gleaned from listening to her father and his friends, and from her brother's letters home. But then had come Falkirk, a victory, but a costly one, followed by retreat. Rumour had attended the flight of the prince's army to the north, and not a soul doubted but that their flight led to destruction. Miss Margaret, desperate at the rumours, left her home at the dead of night in the cold March spring and went to find the man she loved. Now here the account had been uncertain. Whether it was that she had found the man and he had spurned her, or that she hadn't found him in time and been forced to turn back from Culloden Moor, but in any case, turn back she did. And the day after the battle, she had fallen into the hands of a band of English soldiers.
"Dreadful what they did to her,"
Miss Cowden said, lowering her voice as though the figure in the chair could hear.
"Dreadful."
The English soldiers, blind with the lust of the hunt and the kill, pursuing the fugitives of Culloden, hadn't stopped to ask her name or the sympathies of her family. They had known by her speech that she was a Scot, and that knowledge had been enough. They had left her for dead in a ditch half full of freezing water, and only the fortuitous presence of a family of tinkers, hiding in the nearby brambles for fear of the soldiers, had saved her.
"I canna help but think it a pity they did save her, unchristian thing it is to say,"
Miss Cowden whispered.
"If not, the poor lamb might have slipped at her earthly bonds and gone happy to God. But as it is..."
She gestured clumsily at the silent figure and drank down the last drops of her cordial. Margaret had lived, but didn't speak. Somewhat recovered, but silent, she travelled with the tinkers, moving south with them to avoid the pillaging of the Highlands that took place in the wake of Culloden. And then, one day, sitting in the yard of a pothouse, holding the tin to collect coppers as the tinkers busked and sang, she had been found by her brother, who had stopped with his Campbell regiment to refresh themselves on the way back to their quarters at Edinburgh.
"She kent him, and him her, and the shock of their meeting gave her back her voice, but not her mind, poor thing. He took her home, of course, but she was always as though she was in the past.
Sometime before she met the Hielan man. Her father was dead then from the influenza, and Tilly Lawson said as the shock of seeing her like that killed her mother.
But could be as that were the influenza too, for there was a great deal of it about that year."
The whole affair had left Archibald Campbell deeply embittered against both Highland Scots and the English army, and he had resigned his commission. With his parents dead, he found himself middling well-to-do, but the sole support of his damaged sister.
"He could not marry," Miss Cowden explained, "for what woman would have him, and she?"
with a nod toward the fire, was thrown into the bargain. In his difficulties, he had turned to God and become a minister. Unable to leave his sister or to bear the confinement of the family house at Burnt Island with her, he had purchased a coach, hired a woman to look after Margaret, and began to make brief journeys into the surrounding countryside to preach, often taking her with him. In his preaching he had found success, and this year had been asked by the Society of Presbyterian Missionaries if he would undertake his longest journey yet, to the West Indies, there to organise churches and appoint elders on the colonies of Barbados and Jamaica. Prayer had given him his answer, and he had sold the family property in Burnt Island and moved his sister to Edinburgh while he made preparations for the journey. I glanced once more at the figure by the fire. The heated air from the hearth stirred the skirts about her feet, but beyond that small movement she might have been a statue. "Well," I said with a sigh, "there's not a great deal I can do for her, I'm afraid. But I'll give you some prescriptions, receipts, I mean, to have made up at the apothecary's before you go." If they didn't help, they couldn't hurt, I reflected, as I copied down the short lists of ingredients. Chamomile, hops, rue, tansy and verbena, with a strong pinch of peppermint for a soothing tonic. Tea of rose hips to help correct the slight nutritional deficiency I had noted. Spongy, bleeding gums, and a pale, bloated look about the face. "Once you reach the Indies," I said, handing Miss Cowden the paper, "you must see that she eats a great deal of fruit, oranges, grapefruit, and lemons particularly." "You should do the same," I added, causing a look of profound suspicion to flit across the maid's wide face. I doubted she ate any vegetable matter beyond the occasional onion or potato, save her daily porridge. The Reverend Campbell hadn't returned, and I saw no real reason to wait for him. Bidding Miss Campbell adieu, I pulled open the door of the bedroom to find young Ian standing on the other side of it.
"Oh," he said, startled, "I was just coming to find you, Auntie. It's nearly 3:30, and Uncle Jamie said..." "Jamie!"
The voice came from behind me, from the chair beside the fire. Miss Cowden and I whirled to find Miss Campbell sitting bolt upright, eyes still wide but focused now. They were focused on the doorway, and as young Ian stepped inside, Miss Campbell began to scream. Rather unsettled by the encounter with Miss Campbell, young Ian and I made our way thankfully back to the refuge of the brothel, where we were greeted matter-of-factly by Bruno and taken to the rear parlour. There we found Jamie and Fergus deep in conversation.
"True, we do not trust Sir Percival," Fergus was saying. "But in this case, what point is there to his telling you of an ambush, save that such an ambush is in fact to occur?"
"Damned if I ken why," Jamie said frankly, leaning back and stretching in his chair.
"And that being so, we do, as you say, conclude that there's meant to be an ambush by the excisemen. 2 days," he said. "That will be Mullins Cove."
Then, catching sight of me and Ian, he half rose, motioning us to take seats.
"Will it be the rocks below Balcarres, then?" Fergus asked.
Jamie frowned in thought, the two stiff fingers of his right hand drumming slowly on the tabletop.
"No," he said at last. "Let it be Arbroath, the wee cove under the abbey there, just to be sure, aye?" "All right."
Fergus pushed back the half-empty plate of oat cakes from which he'd been refreshing himself, and rose.
"I shall spread the word, milor. Arbroath, in 4 days."
With a nod to me, he swirled his cloak about his shoulders and went out.
"Is it the smuggling, uncle?"
young Ian asked eagerly.
"Is there a French lugger coming?"
He picked up an oat cake and bit into it, scattering crumbs over the table. Jamie's eyes were still abstracted, thinking, but they cleared as he glanced sharply at his nephew.
"Aye, it is. And you, young Ian, are having nothing to do with it."
"But I could help," the boy protested. "You'll need someone to hold the mules, at least." "After all your da said to you and me yesterday, wee Ian," Jamie raised his brows. "Christ, you've a short memory, lad."
Ian looked mildly abashed at this, and took another oatcake to cover his confusion. Seeing him momentarily silent, I took the opportunity to ask my own questions.
"You're going to Arbroath to meet a French ship that's bringing in smuggled liquor?" I asked. "You don't think that's dangerous, after Sir Percival's warning?"
Jamie glanced at me with one brow still raised, but answered patiently enough.
"No, Sir Percival was warning me that the rendezvous in 2 days' time is noon. That was to take place at Mullins Cove. I've an arrangement with Jared and his captains, though. If a rendezvous cannot be kept for some reason, the lugger will stand offshore and come in again the next night, but to a different place. And there's a third fallback as well, should the second meeting not come off."
"But if Sir Percival knows the first rendezvous, won't he know the others too?" I persisted. Jamie shook his head and poured out a cup of wine. He quirked a brow at me to ask whether I wanted any, and upon my shaking my head, sipped it himself.
"No," he said. "The rendezvous points are arranged in sets of three between me and Jared, sent by sealed letter inside a packet addressed to Jean here. Once I've read the letter, I burn it. The men who'll help meet the lugger will all know the first point, of course. I suppose one of them will have let something slip," he added, frowning into his cup. "But no one, not even Fergus, kens the other 2 points unless we need to make use of one. And when we do, all the men ken well enough to guard their tongues."
"But then it's bound to be safe, Uncle," young Ian burst out. "Please let me come. I'll keep well back out of the way," he promised.
Jamie gave his nephew a slightly jaundiced look.
"Aye, you will," he said. "You'll come with me to Arbroath, but you and your auntie will stay at the inn on the road above the abbey until we've finished. I've got to take the laddie home to Lallybroch, Clare," he explained, turning to me, "and mend things as best I can with his parents."
The elder Ian had left Halliday's that morning before Jamie and young Ian arrived, leaving no message, but presumably bound for home.
"You will not mind the journey. I would not ask it, and you just over your travel from Inverness."
His eyes met mine with a small conspiratorial smile.
"But I must take him back as soon as maybe."
"I don't mind at all," I assured him. "It'll be good to see Jenny and the rest of your family again."
"But Uncle," young Ian blurted, "what about..."
"Be still," Jamie snapped. "That will be all from you, laddie. Not another word, I..."
Young Ian looked wounded, but took another oatcake and inserted it into his mouth in a marked manner, signifying his intention to remain completely silent. Jamie relaxed then and smiled at me.
"Well, and how was your visit to the madwoman?"
"Very interesting," I said. "Jamie, do you know any people named Campbell?"
"Not above 300 or 400 of them," he said, a smile twitching his long mouth. "Had ye a particular Campbell in mind?"
"A couple of them." I told him the story of Archibald Campbell and his sister Margaret, as related to me by Nellie Cowden. He shook his head at the tale and sighed. For the first time he looked truly older, his face tightened and lined by memory.
"It's no the worst tale I've heard of the things that happened after Culloden," he said. "But I dinna think..." "Wait."
He stopped and looked at me, eyes narrowed in thought. "Margaret Campbell. Margaret. Would she be a bonny wee lass, perhaps the size of the second Mary, a wee soft brown hair like a wren's feather, and a vera sweet face?" "She probably was 20 years ago," I said, thinking of that still, plump figure sitting by the fire. "Why, do you know her after all?"
"Aye, I think I do."
His brow was furrowed in thought, and he looked down at the table, drawing a random line through the spilled crumbs.
"Aye, if I'm right, she was Ewan Cameron's sweetheart. You'll mind Ewan?"
"Of course." Ewan had been a tall, handsome joker of a man who had worked with Jamie at Holyrood, gathering bits of intelligence that filtered through from England. "What's become of Ewan? Or should I not ask?" I said, seeing the shadow come over Jamie's face. "The English shot him," he said quietly, 2 days after Culloden." He closed his eyes for a moment, then opened them and smiled tiredly at me.
"Well, then, may God bless the Reverend Archie Campbell. I've heard of him a time or two during the Rising. He was a bold soldier, folks said, and a brave one. And I suppose he'll need to be now, poor man."
He sat a moment longer, then stood up with decision.
"I will. There's a great deal to be done before we leave Edinburgh. Ian, you'll find the list of the print shop customers upstairs on the table. Fetch it down to me, and I'll mark off for you the ones with orders outstanding. You must go to see each one and offer back their money. Unless they choose to wait until I've found new premises and laid in new stock, that might take as much as 2 months, though. Tell them."
He patted his coat where something made a small jingling sound.
"Luckily, the assurance money will pay back the customers and have a bit left over. Speaking of which..."
He turned and smiled at me.
"Your job, Sassenach, is to find a dressmaker who will manage ye a decent gown in 2 days' time. For I expect Daphne would like her dress back, and I cannot take ye home to Lallybroch naked."
Chapter 30. Rendezvous. The chief entertainment of the ride north to Arbroath was watching the conflict of wills between Jamie and young Ian. I knew from long experience that stubbornness was one of the major components of a Fraser's character. Ian seemed not unduly handicapped in that respect, though only half a Fraser. Either the Murrays were no slouches with regard to stubbornness, or the Fraser genes were strong ones. Having had the opportunity to observe Brianna at close range for many years, I had my own opinion about that, but kept quiet, merely enjoying the spectacle of Jamie having for once met his match. By the time we passed Balfour, he was wearing a distinctly hunted look. This contest between immovable object and irresistible force continued until early evening of the fourth day, when we reached Arbroath to find that the inn, where Jamie had intended to leave Ian and myself, no longer existed. No more than a tumbled-down stone wall and one or two charred roof beams remained to mark the spot. Otherwise, the road was deserted for miles in either direction. Jamie looked at the heap of stones in silence for some time. It was reasonably obvious that he couldn't just leave us in the middle of a desolate, muddy road. Ian, wise enough not to press the advantage, kept also silent, though his skinny frame fairly vibrated with eagerness.
"All right, then," Jamie said at last, resigned. "You'll come. But only so far as the cliff's edge, Ian. Do you hear? You'll take care of your auntie."
"I hear, Uncle Jamie,"
young Ian replied with deceptive meekness. I caught Jamie's wry glance, though, and understood that if Ian was to take care of Auntie, Auntie was also to take care of Ian. I hid a smile, nodding obediently. The rest of the men were timely, arriving at the rendezvous point on the cliffside just after dark. A couple of the men seemed vaguely familiar, but most were just muffled shapes. It was 2 days past the dark of the moon, but the tiny sliver rising over the horizon made conditions here little more illuminating than those obtained in the brothel cellars. No introductions were made, the men greeting Jamie with unintelligible mutters and grunts. There was one unmistakable figure, though. A large mule-drawn wagon appeared, rattling its way down the road, driven by Fergus, and a diminutive object that could only be Mr. Willoughby, whom I hadn't seen since he had shot the mysterious man on the stairs of the brothel. "He hasn't a pistol with him tonight, I hope," I murmured to Jamie.
"Who?"
he said, squinting into the gathering gloom.
"Oh, the Chinee? No, none of them have."
Before I could ask why not, he had gone forward to help back the wagon around, ready to make a getaway toward Edinburgh so soon as the contraband should be loaded. Young Ian pressed his way forward, and I, mindful of my job as custodian, followed him. Mr. Willoughby stood on tiptoe to reach into the back of the wagon, emerging with an odd-looking lantern, fitted with a pierced metal top and sliding metal sides.